You cannot lose games in the NFL and still win.
One day I understand. One day, go see the baby be born and come back. You're a Major League Baseball player.
Did I not tell you?
Yes, you did.
See, don't answer. These are rhetorical questions because you know I told you and you know I'm not.
Analytics don't work at all. They're just a crap to some people who were really smart, made up to try to get in the game because they had no talent.
This kid is a gamer. He's a follower. He's a playmaker and a shot caller.
In case you didn't know,
I got T-Bone. He shattered the mold. And all he does is win. All he does is win.
Hello and welcome to Hot Takedown, 538 Sports Podcast. I'm Chadwick Matlin, an editor at 538. With me, in the same room, all of us together at last, after months.
Reunited, and it feels so good.
It's the
feels
full
so
crew.
Good.
Kate Fagan, ESPNW columnist. Hello, Kate.
Hi, Chad.
Neil Payne.
Hey, Chad.
538 writer. Hello, Neil.
How you doing?
How are we doing today, guys?
So good. It's so good to be here.
It's wonderful to see you.
It's really good.
Now, Kate, you're stopping by, but then you're going on book leave.
I am.
Are we allowed
2 weeks of book leave.
Oh, that's a speedy book leave.
I've got 15,000 words to write in 2 weeks, and then the book will be done.
So we have to set up the vigil in the corner again, is what you're saying?
Yeah.
Good thing we didn't throw it out.
Yeah, you guys just pull it out of the closet and bring it back.
15K in 2 weeks.
Yep.
And do you know what those 15K are going to be?
I know what they're supposed to be. I have the outline, but I got to infuse it with heart.
Are you going on a retreat somewhere? Are you getting like a nice cabin?
I'm not looking at social media.
That's a retreat.
Yes. I need my brain to start functioning at a higher level.
So if we see you tweeting, we should like angrily scold
you.
Yes,
you should.
All right. Take the phone away. All right, on today's show, we're going to talk about the sad passing of Pat Summitt, the legendary Tennessee women's basketball coach who died at the age of 64 on Monday, succumbing to her early onset Alzheimer's. We'll remember her and her legacy and talk about just how great those Tennessee teams were for two decades. And then on to the NBA, where Derrick Rose is suddenly a Knick and the Knicks are suddenly relevant. Chris Herring from the Wall Street Journal will swing by to talk to us about whether Rose is an upgrade and what the Knicks are up to. And then Chris will stick around as we zoom out from New York and talk about the league's free agency period as a whole, especially the Thunder. We'll talk about Serge Ibaka, who is now on the Magic, and Kevin Durant, wherever he ends up. All right, now, Pat Summitt was a titan of her sport and of all sports, really. She shaped what basketball looked like and meant for a generation of fans, is the winningest coach of all time in Division I college basketball and the winner of 8 NCAA championships. Her passing has prompted moving tributes, including one from our own Kate Fagan. Kate, you wrote on ESPNW today that you grew up wanting to impress Pat Summitt. What did you mean by that?
Well, when the news came out even a few days ago that she was nearing the end, I started thinking a lot about growing up in the 90s and playing AAU hoops and how so many of us, I remember, would always have our eye on the door of like what coach might walk in the door. And even in practices or in tournaments where there weren't coaches, I remember we would always talk about Pat Summitt and we all read her books and we all pointed to her as the face of our sport. And so when I say we all wanted to impress her, I meant like she challenged all of us, even if we didn't think we could ever play for Tennessee or even if we never would see her at an AAU tournament at our specific game. There was always that idea that what she wanted was for you to find the best within yourself, which I know sounds cheesy, but you have to remember that no one before her had created a foundation of respect for women's basketball. And even now, with Twitter and with comments on blog posts, you growing up as a female player might often already know that there's some pushback about whether you should be respected. That didn't exist in the 90s. That didn't exist. We were completely free to just think that we were respected and admired because all we saw was Pat Summitt.
Mm-hmm.
And there she is on the cover of Sports Illustrated. And there she is on ESPN. And there she is, the equivalent of like a Mike Krzyzewski. And it never entered our minds that anybody thought any differently about our game. And I remember, and now that I know that people do feel differently, a lot of people do, I think back on the freedom we had in the 90s where we genuinely were diving on that floor and thinking, we matter. We matter the same amount that every other AAU player matters. And that was solely, not solely, of course there's other women and men who have built that game, but there was in large part delivered to us by the hard work that Pat Summitt put in.
Kate, in the piece, you tell a story about being in a tunnel, mm-hmm. in a stadium tunnel with Summitt. It was at the and I think listeners should hear that story because it's a great story. And also wondering if that was the only encounter that you had with her. And basically she lived almost as this this larger than life figure that you kept chasing in a way that and made you better as a result.
There are so many, you know, there's I think 175-ish women who played for Pat Summitt. And they have their own memorable stories about how she molded them. My piece was for the millions of young girls who weren't good enough to play for Tennessee, and yet they were, but like you mentioned, by the sheer force of her will existing within women's basketball, shaped by her in a different way. And I had thought when I was like 15 or 16, I was like, if I ever got, I remember reading her books, if I ever got a college scholarship, I would consider turning it down to go walk on at Tennessee. Because there were moments where you thought, as a young kid, that there was nothing more impressive than being a Pat Summitt
player. That would be the pinnacle.
That would be the pinnacle. Not having a college scholarship, but like listening to Pat Summitt tell you how to play basketball.
So before we get to the metrics, I want to listen to some tape of Pat Summitt in the locker room speaking to her players.
I don't know about y'all, but I want to win a national championship. And I don't think they're in as good a shape as we are. It's yours. It just depends on how much it means to you. It's a team that really wants it, that has everybody committed to what they have to do. This is a chance of a lifetime. You can't be afraid to go out and compete and do whatever it takes. We got to have communication, but we must have composure. We didn't have composure all the time. And have a sense of urgency. Anytime we call something, you got a sense of urgency. You want to get something done. And you want to get it done collectively. So all five people have to get where they need to get in a timely fashion. All right? Sense of urgency. Every possession. Every possession matters. Take pride in every possession. It's a game of possessions. It's also a game of wheels. See how tough we are this
season.
So in the column I wrote, I talk about how in 2003 we were playing in the Sweet 16 in Knoxville, and we were playing Villanova, and then Tennessee was playing Penn State, and I had forgotten after morning shoot-around an item on the arena floor, empty, ran back to get it, and then as I'm going back to the bus, Pat Summitt was at the top of the tunnel and I was at the bottom, and there was just the two of us. And I'm not suggesting I know Pat Summitt because of this moment. I just remember the amount of effort it took me to, like, keep her gaze and absorb like her nod, and then knowing like 12-year-old me thought it was the greatest moment ever. And I was texting my dad today because we lost that game to Villanova, and part of the loss was being eliminated from the tournament. A bigger part of the loss, and he even said this, was knowing that if we had won that game, we would have played Tennessee in the Elite Eight. And as a kid, you just wanted Pat Summitt to, like, watch you play.
Mm-hmm. And even then, if she beat you.
Even if she beat you. And I remember all of us, as we talked about it, we were like, man, losing was one thing, but then losing that opportunity to, like, walk onto a floor and shake her hand afterward, knowing how much all of us felt about, like, who she was and how she had inspired all of us. Like, and I remember even my trainer texted me today saying how, like, even our head coach was watching, you know, the game the next day, and even she was exuding that, like, this missed opportunity to coach against Pat Summitt. And I think all of us who ever picked up a ball, or like even any female athlete, we feel like it's amazing how much she gave us this self-respect that we could then build off of.
So Neil, for 538 today, you put together some numbers. I mean, in some ways, metrics and numbers feel like they don't even come close to the, right, to the legacy that titans of their sport leave behind. We talked about that before when other people have passed. But we did look at some of this stuff for Summitt, and you found that she was – that even the numbers confirm her greatness.
Right, yeah. First of all, I wanted to say, especially about the 98 Tennessee team and, like, Shamiqua Holdsclaw, and what you were saying, Kate, about the, like, not knowing any better. You know, you and I are about the same age, and I remember the Sports Illustrated, you know, also, and just kind of like, that team was cool, you know?
Yeah.
It was like...
the three Meeks.
Right, exactly. and I felt like that was... I don't know if this is true, but it felt like it was, like, the first time that a women's basketball team sort of elevated to the status of just sort of like that cachet in the basketball culture of being just like the coolest team, you know, cooler than the men's teams that year.
Totally.
But anyway, that is not a statistical assessment. So to your point, Chad, yeah, we've talked about this a lot and on Hot Takedown about how difficult it is to get data, especially historical data for women's sports. And today, you know, trying to write a story off of Pat Summitt's passing proved, you know, difficult in those same ways that we always talk about, where there isn't a go-to place. Basketball Reference, has WNBA players, but it's really tough to figure out which one of them played for Tennessee, even though I could figure that out on the men's side in two clicks. And so eventually I was able to look at the poll data, which is kind of like
the AP poll, like the AP poll,
which is in and of itself sort of also along the same lines of I could get, you know, power ratings that use stats instead of the opinion of sports writers going back further than the 70s in men's sports. But in this case, I had to use the AP poll. But if you kind of figure out a way to give like a scoring system based on where a team finished in the poll at the end of the season, and then you kind of add that up over the years, the first women's AP poll was in 1977, you find that the best program of that whole era, the 77 to 16, yeah, is Tennessee. And by not a small margin either. So we think about UConn and we talk about them a lot. And certainly they, in some ways, have surpassed some of the teams that Pat Summitt built at Tennessee. But for the entirety of sort of the era in which the AP felt that it was, you know, felt the obligation to or deigned to make a poll for the women's side, which is, again, sad that it's only been 40 years, that the Tennessee is the class of women's basketball programs in that era. And to me, even more impressive is if you look at her career, or at least the segment that kind of came after 77, because she started coaching a few years before that at Tennessee, on a per season basis, Tennessee was better than UConn on a per season basis has been under Gino Auriemma. So I think, you know, those are also kind of testaments to just the type of program that that Pat Summitt built. And, you know, I don't know if she was really ever forgotten with UConn sort of ascending to this thing, but we talk about UConn a ton. And we should also, you know, talk about how great Tennessee was.
There's so many numbers you can throw at Pat Summitt's legacy, like wins in years.
Which she is the all-time leader,
right,
in, men or women.
You know, and those are so important as we talk about numbers to sort of put shape on how you feel emotionally. But the best way to, like, try and understand what she means to female athletes is to point out that, like, so many of us, when we were in, like, the malleable youth stage, we drew from her a belief that we were respected. And now going forward, when I hear people criticize female athletes or women's sports, it doesn't really matter as much to me. It doesn't cut to my heart because I was already standing on the platform that Pat Summitt built. And so when I was coming of age, I believed and I was told that we mattered and we were respected. And so by the time I then started hearing we weren't, and a lot of that was the advent of social media.
Right.
When I started hearing that, it was like, well, I've already formed my opinion of who I am and who female athletes are because Pat Summitt existed. Are you kidding me? No, nobody to be like her was everything. And right. I think there's a million girls out there who feel the same way.
Well, this is what I was thinking. I was thinking about our past conversations around, especially in women's sports, whether parity or dominance is better for a sport. We talked about that a lot with UConn, as Neil mentioned. And we've spoken about parity for other sports, too. And it strikes me that in this instance, dominance really had an effect far beyond the league. You know, it has a social cultural effect, essentially, that when you have when you have a person and a team in this instance, and they're obviously very closely linked, that is something to aspire to, as you're saying, Kate. It has a significant it warps people's expectations about themselves and about where they want to go. And that's something that parity never quite gets to, right? Like I can tell you that, like in baseball, for example, there's no coach or player or team even that feels like the one person or mm-hmm. one team that, you know, that a person should aspire to. It's their, it's each person's hometown team, let's say, or it's their favorite player because they happen to get the baseball card at some birthday party or something. But for what you're saying is that in women's basketball, there right. was one. And maybe that's the case now with UConn for girls that are growing up now, you know, that,
yeah.
but there is a real value to there being one destination.
Right. And even some of the data that I looked into today, that I didn't know this beforehand, that the period of the greatest growth in high school girls' basketball participation after the, you know, big spike that followed Title IX, and then it kind of dipped, you know, almost just as quickly in the late 70s, was a sustained decade between 1988 and 1998 in which the number of girls that played basketball increased 20%, which is the most of any kind of 10-year stretch in the data set that I had, which doesn't include the last 5 years, but, you know, should be pretty representative. And I thought it was so fitting. Right. I'm not sure if it's necessarily, you know, if the link is how much is coincidental and how much is causal, but that Pat Summitt's best Tennessee decade came exactly between 1988 and 1998. And I do think that that speaks to, you know, the idea that, like, that team, especially culminating in that 1998 team, was sort of such an inspiration to people and especially to girls to play that that it really was no coincidence that the era of the 90s was also kind of the time in which it saw the most growth in girls actually, you know, picking up the sport.
Right, because it's not as if we think that that growth was caused by Pat Summitt. More so it's that during that growth, when so many more girls were picking up the hoop, they had Pat Summitt books to read. They had the mm-hmm. cover of SI to be inspired by, and she became emblematic of how to become better and who you can think about impressing if you do want to become better, which then led to better hoops in the 2000s.
And she still won, even though presumably not all of that increased participation went to Tennessee. She was still able to beat the rivals that in some ways she helped create because the game became more popular.
All right. Listeners, I would highly encourage you to read Kate's piece about Pat Summitt at ESPNW.
And Neil's when it goes up.
And Neil's when it
and
goes up.
And that book, I didn't know. After I read your story and you mentioned the book about the 1998 Tennessee team, I didn't know it existed. And so I went out and I got it on Kindle like instantly.
What's the
oh my God, you're going to consume it
Raise
in like 8 hours because it's so good.
Excellent. All right. Let's move on to the NBA. After years of stagnant, disappointing basketball on the court and in the front office, the Knicks are making some moves. They traded Robin Lopez, Jerian Grant, and Jose Calderon for Derrick Rose and suddenly have what some might call a core to build around. This is an alien idea for Knicks fans, of course. To discuss, we asked Chris Herring, an NBA writer for the Wall Street Journal, to join us. Chris, welcome back to Hot Takedown.
I appreciate you guys having me on again. Thank you.
All right, so Chris, let's maybe start with a hot take. Here's Adam Schein telling us why the Derrick Rose trade means big things for the next season of the Knicks.
We have a trade. The New York Knicks have traded for Derrick Rose. Yes, we can. As a diehard Knicks fan, I absolutely, positively love this deal. This is a no-brainer. A no-brainer for the Knicks. This is something I can't get enough. And I'm going to tell you what yesterday gave us as in Knicks fans. A little juice, a little sizzle, a little moxie, a little excitement. The girls are excited. They want to see Derrick Rose play. I can't get enough.
Whoa.
The girls are excited.
That went off the rails at the end there.
Yeah. So, Chris, let's leave that sexist comment aside and go to the basketball of the situation. Derrick Rose was sensational before he was injured however many times over. Is there any evidence that the Knicks, that Adam Schein is correct to be as excited as he is with the version of Derrick Rose that the Knicks are actually getting?
I mean, if this was 2011 or 2012, that segment would have been like perfectly placed. But I mean, let's be real here. I mean, it's kind of impossible to judge it totally until we get a chance to see how he looks physically. You know, he's still physically, he looks okay now at this point. He made it through most of last season. I think he missed 16 games last year. And I mean, even with that, I think he's still a sizable upgrade from what the Knicks had on their roster last year at point guard. But I, you know, it's funny. I've been on the Knicks beat for 4 years now, and you know, I'm very upfront about my personal life in terms of where I'm from and, you know, like where I grew up and the fact that I used to be a Bulls fan, you know, growing up during the Jordan years. But, you know, I think it's funny because a lot of the same people that always accuse me of kind of having a Bulls bias now are now arguing with me on the Rose trade, which I've, you know, I've critiqued a little bit of saying that, you know, I'm surprised the Knicks gave up this much to get a guy that hasn't been productive in 5 years. And so it's, you know, I think I was a little bit surprised that the Knicks gave up Robin Lopez. He's not a star player by any means. Doesn't have the name recognition that Derrick Rose does. But, you know, the Knicks should have been the team that had some leverage here just because the Bulls, you know, not completely similar to the Andrea Bargnani trade where the Knicks are giving up a first-round pick to get a guy that, you know, a team might have amnestied anyway. But the Bulls were very clearly looking to wash their hands of Rose and potentially Jimmy Butler, too. I mean, they almost traded him on draft night, it sounded like. And so, you know, it's just awkward to kind of see the Knicks give up a guy that, you know, was not a home run signing for them last summer, but was a solid double, and Robin Lopez did the dirty work for them. I put a number in a story last week saying that they shot 54% when they took shots following his screens as opposed to like 45% on anybody else's screens on the team. You know, something that kind of goes unseen, really. And, you know, Kristaps Porzingis rebounded better with him on the court because Robin Lopez is very, very good at boxing multiple players out at one time. Little stuff like that, if you want to call it little, that's important.
Well, Chris, welcome to my brain as one of those Knicks fans who I allow for the irrationality of the fact that I'm excited about this trade.
Or that you're a Knicks fan in the first place.
Right. Maybe that's irrational in the first place. And I totally agree with you on the concern I have with Brook Lopez now being traded and the impact
Robin Brook. Yeah, they're all Lopez's.
That's a big deal. One likes mascots, the other doesn't. But I allow for the fact that the Knicks need to go get a center now, or we might see Porzingis slip back in a lot of ways because he was so aided when Lopez was on the floor with him there. But, like, don't you kind of get the excitement from Knicks fans? Now, let me lay it out for you, right? And because on one hand, I think this looks like every trade that the Knicks have made in the last 15 years. And that, by that, I mean an unwillingness to just build through the draft and needing a home run. You can go back,
sure.
Right? Like, you can go to the Steve Francis deal, the McDice deal, all of these deals. But on the other hand, even though I know, Neil, even though I understand that the trade that they made for Derrick Rose is independent of all the other trades, they're, meaning that
like the history
the Lux,
of
the luck that applies to the how many trades can they make in a row where a player underperforms when we get him. I understand that these things are independent. It doesn't mean that just because we've made 12 trades and a player has underperformed every time he's come to New York, that now on the 13th, he will perform better. But do you understand the fans' logic?
They're due,
totally.
Right? They're due about to have one of these things work out.
I finally think he's working hard, Derrick Rose. And now this is going to be the trade the Knicks finally make where somebody overperforms expectations in a New York Knicks uniform.
But Neil, you looked at the numbers and the over, like the Knicks players don't underperform usually, right?
Are you saying that's a story I've told myself?
No.
You said irrational, not me, Kate.
What I did was I looked for the performances of, so like took every player who played for a franchise going back to the merger in the 70s and looked at their performance with that franchise and with every other franchise except that franchise.
Before and after?
Yeah, it just could be any time in their career. And then I tried to figure out like which teams had the biggest tendencies of players playing better when they don't wear the uniform in question. Because I thought the Knicks, you know, this Derrick Rose thing was going to be just the latest in, I was with you, Kate, a long line of the Knicks either pick up somebody who, get rid of somebody who will be good eventually down the road, or pick up somebody whose best days are well behind them. In this case, Derrick Rose seems like his best days are behind him. Certainly, I hope that that's not true. But, you know, I thought that this was kind of a textbook case of that. But as it turns out, the Knicks players don't really perform any better or worse when they wear orange and blue than when they're in any other city in the country. It's just that the Knicks just have players who aren't really all that good, like
as
a general rule.
Well, so how far back did you go for this?
The merger. So like 70s.
Okay, but really I think it's been since about 2002 with that McDice trade.
Sure. I mean,
do you think that maybe they had players who played well in the 70s out that it's skewing the scales?
You know, the Knicks themselves are a team that, you know, for all that we talk about them and kind of the colossal expectations that the city puts on them every year, they haven't won a championship since 73. And they really, you know, aside from a couple of years, which of course are kind of magnified in the minds of every fan as these great moments, they haven't even come especially close. You know, if you kind of compare it to other teams over the same span of years. So, you know, I think as a general rule, the Knicks just aren't really all that great of a team. I mean, in terms of the players that they get, one finding that I did have that I thought was interesting, at least, is, you know, the way I measured the performance of the players was using box plus minus, which is the best of the box score stats that you can find at Basketball Reference. But I also put player efficiency rating in there, which is a stat that's not as good in terms of, you know, telling you who the best players are, but it's related to how they're perceived in terms of, like, you know, do they score a lot? Are they kind of a flashier type of player? Do they do things that show up, you know, stuffing the stat sheet? And I did find that Knicks players stuff the stat sheet more when they're not in Knicks uniforms than when they are. And kind of, you can tell
that explains it,
right? You can almost tell the story of the Knicks having a history of going out and getting players who were perceived to be good, but actually weren't all that good, and then bringing them into the fold. And then they don't play any differently when they get here, but they kind of appear to play differently because they were never actually that good in the first place.
Well, that's interesting because you raised the point immediately. What I started thinking about when you explained what metrics you were using for that. I mean, Mike D'Antoni openly admitted during the Isaiah era that this was right after the Isaiah era, but he basically admitted to the fact that they kind of inflated guys' numbers by just playing a wide open system, not worrying about defense,
right,
and trying to up the trade value of players by really just inflating their numbers and having guys just shoot crazy shots. I mean, you had a lot of guys during that era that, since they've left, you know, between, and some of these guys were the Isaiah era, but like Randolph and Jamal Crawford, all sorts of guys that like had panned out and been better players since they left. And I think the Knicks knew they had that ability, but they could never really find the right group of players to mesh with each other. And so it's funny that, you know, that those numbers actually get better when they go elsewhere, or are better when they are elsewhere.
So Chris, let me ask you, as someone who obviously follows the team very closely, it seems, based on some work that actually ran in the journal, that the Rose and Calderon are very different players. That the way they play point guard is quite different. And so, what's the team that the Knicks are going to build around Rose, Porzingis, and Carmelo going to look like? I mean, if they don't get a center, are they going to play Porzingis at the five? Are there any tea leaves that are floating around?
Well, to me, I mean, listening to them, they make it sound as if the five may be their biggest priority in free agency, which I don't necessarily know that I agree with that. Obviously, I don't think Porzingis is ready to be a full-time center, and I think that's okay. I mean, that's part of the reason that I kind of would have liked Lopez to stay put unless they'd found a better deal. But clearly, if you're going to have Melo and Rose on the court together, you need guys a couple things. You need one, a guy that is okay with not having the ball all that much, which is why Lopez was kind of good for them, I thought. Because, you know, Melo and Rose are both ball dominant. It kind of makes you wonder what sort of role Porzingis is going to play. All of a sudden, he's not probably the second option anymore. You also want a guy that can shoot. You know, I saw Sam Amick, the great USA Today reporter, reported that the Knicks are interested in DeMar DeRozan. And I immediately just kind of looked at the story and just kind of was blinking my eyes really quick, because I'm like, why would the Knicks want him? He can't shoot, and Rose can't shoot threes very well either. And so that would not be really a match made in heaven from an offensive standpoint. Two guys that both like to penetrate but can't shoot.
Yeah, and it's so funny that you mentioned DeRozan, because he would be another example of a player who had like a really high player efficiency rating in Toronto, and then would be such a bad fit with this current Knicks roster that would contribute
fit
to that average that we talked about earlier.
All right, so let's talk about the league as a whole now and move on to free agency as a whole. I guess we should start with Kevin Durant, right? That seems to make the most sense. He's the biggest ticket item on the market at the moment. And it seems as though this is like an old-fashioned nobody knows where he's going to go situation. It doesn't, from what I've seen, there isn't a suggestion that that any team besides maybe the Thunder have a pole position. Are all the teams, Chris, from where you sit, from a metrics and from a fit standpoint? I mean, is there a bad choice for Kevin Durant to make, or do you not subscribe to the idea that, you know, there are certain fits that maybe won't work for Durant?
I don't know. I mean, he's being really strategic in terms of the reported teams that he's interested in talking with. I mean, the win-loss wise, the worst two teams that he's looking at, I think, are Boston and Miami, and those are both pretty good options considering that they were winning teams either without a real true bona fide star with Boston, or in Miami, a team that was missing, you know, Chris Bosh for, you know, the whole second half of the season. And so you plug a star into either one of those situations and they obviously improve. And then the other ones, you know, like Golden State and the Spurs, if he stays put where he is, that's not a bad option. They were one win away from the finals. And so, I mean, really all those options sound great when you think about it. If you're just talking about fit in terms of a team where he doesn't appear to fit that well, or something that definitely doesn't guarantee him, you know, easy access to the finals, I mean, the Celtics would be a powerhouse right away if he went there.
Well, you know, I'm always a fan of kind of, not basketball chaos, but kind of these melting pots and these experiments where you take players and throw them into unprecedented or weird situations. That's why I would love to see Kevin Durant on the Warriors, just to kind of see how that would work out, because it's such a different spot than they were.
There was an ESPN headline today that said, if Durant joins the Warriors, will they go 82-0?
That's a little crazy. That's kind of crazy. But yeah, Durant, you know, what's fascinating to me about it is that he kind of, aside from the fact that you would be slotting out somebody like Harrison Barnes, who had like, you know, a usage of 16%, and putting in this guy that has like 30-something% usage in place, you know, Kevin Durant can pass the ball a little bit. He certainly has, you know, no flaws as a shooter. So what do you think about the fit on that team? Would that be like an amazing, beautiful basketball experiment, or would he just be better off playing alongside Russell Westbrook like he has been?
Well, here's where it gets interesting. I mean, I don't subscribe to the idea that, you know, maybe record-wise they get worse, but maybe they just get worse because, you know, they decide they're not going to go for the record again, or, you know, because they've already broken it. But I think the biggest consideration with that, one of the coolest arguments that my coworker, Ben, hopefully he doesn't kill me for saying this publicly, you know, I don't think he's going to write about it, but, you know, the best argument for a while, especially when Golden State was still in line to win the title, he was making the argument that the Durant going to the Warriors might be most interested in that just because if they get him, it means nobody else does. And so it kind of helps them with their supremacy because, you know, Durant is the clear guy that looks like he might change teams. That, you know, if he gets the fact to go somewhere, he really shifts the balance of something in that conference. If he goes to the Warriors, who's getting better than they are? And so that's the interesting part of it to me. But the other part of it, too, you know, Durant, we so quickly have kind of taken his health for granted after he just missed, you know, most of the year before this. And so it seems like an easy enough thing. You're not going to suffer that much if you lose Harrison Barnes and let him walk. And if you, you know, if you get Durant instead, obviously, you know, everybody would take that upgrade. But, yeah, there is a concern just from the standpoint of, you know, Steph gets as many shots as he does. He figured Durant opens up the floor for everybody else because of how great a player he is. But it probably does take some wrangling to just kind of figure out, like, how that's going to work offensively. You would make it work. They would have more talent than anybody. But yeah, I mean, I think the first reason is a better reason to go out and get him and make sure that you've got him on your team, honestly, just to make sure that, you know, the Spurs don't get him.
Chris, you know, we can talk all we want about what fit Durant is for a specific team, but it's kind of ignoring a larger conversation going around Durant that I think fans have, which is, does he lose a value in his title if he leaves Oklahoma City? And I was wondering, and maybe we can do this next week, Neil, or sometime going forward when we know where Durant lands. I think we have this idea that since free agency in the last 20 years, as players move and perhaps go somewhere that they think is a better basketball fit for them, that they are more likely to win a title. I would love if we can look and see guys who have signed in free agency elsewhere. Is there a higher percentage that they have won titles than when they stay put? Because it seems like we
have. Oh, interesting.
If Kevin Durant does go to Golden City, he's going to lose some of that LeBron James shine of like winning one for your city and where you're drafted. And that's certainly a conversation for fans to have. But I kind of, as I look back, I'm wondering if there's any way to bring numbers to whether or not NBA players do find it easier in terms of how the percentage that they win a title with a free agent destination signing.
And also the idea of, you know, like you were mentioning before, Chris, about the conference disparity. Like, I wonder how much, you know, as fans, I don't think that gets taken into account when we talk about, like, certainly LeBron with the decision. Everybody was talking about his teammates and the talent that he was playing with and how that made things easier and that, you know, it was kind of an easy way out compared to Cleveland. But nobody was saying, you know, like, he stayed in the East. Mm-hmm. And that was actually, in retrospect, I think if we look at LeBron's arc of his career and the fact that he's been to six straight finals, that is actually the biggest consideration of all, is just not having to go to the West puts you in a position to, you know, make it to the conference finals almost like at a minimum. So if I were a free agent, and I wonder how much of this calculation actually goes on in the head of somebody like a Kevin Durant, is if it made sense at all, money-wise and kind of city-wise and quality of life-wise, why not go to the Eastern Conference? You know, it seems like it would be so much easier to make the finals that
you
way.
You never
so
hear let anybody me ask- cite that almost ever. I mean, the only guy I can really think of that really made the shift from West to East, and it wasn't in terms of free agency, it was a trade, it was Garnett.
Right.
Life obviously became a lot better for him really quickly in terms of, you know, winning the big one.
So let me ask about the other thing that's going on with the Thunder, which was the trade that they made on draft night, sending Serge Ibaka to the Magic for Victor Oladipo and a few other players, I believe. It seemed as though this was about basketball fit in a way, that Ibaka sort of couldn't find a role with the Thunder night in and night out that fit with the emergence of Steven Adams as well as Enes Kanter. And so as a result, they shipped him, and everyone seems to think the Thunder got a steal. Neil, you wrote about this trade. Is that where you came down?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, I like Oladipo as a player anyway, and he's a young player, you know, that can continue to improve. And then you look at Ibaka, especially during the playoffs this year, and he kind of, it was so stunning to see someone who was almost at the forefront of like the modern stretch four revolution, if you will, sort of lose his spot, or they kind of couldn't figure out how they wanted to use him at certain points, especially late in the playoffs, that it made a lot of sense to kind of move on with the pieces that they had. Is that a fair assessment, Chris?
I think so. I mean, it's always, you know, in a vacuum, it's always a lot easier to say, like, how do you give up this guy? But then when you read Ibaka's agent's comment and basically says, we kind of expected a bigger role, we talked about a bigger role, and then there was no bigger role, I mean, that's kind of a textbook reason for someone, you know, especially when you look at how the money is changing and you look at Ibaka's skill set. I mean, from a number standpoint, the most interesting thing to me about him, he wanted a bigger role on offense, but seeing how much less he was doing defensively, his shot block per game went from like pretty much like, I think it was close to 3.5 at one point, maybe 4 years ago, and it's slowly declined all the way down to less than 2. Every year it's been less and less. And so, you know, that dynamic and kind of trying to up his value before he becomes a free agent next year. And Oklahoma City has always been really, really big on getting rid of guys before their contracts are up. Harden, Reggie Jackson, now Ibaka. And I think Oladipo by himself is great return, let alone Ilyasova also being part of that deal as well.
All right, Chris Herring from the Wall Street Journal. Listeners, you can read his work in the Journal. Thanks so much for coming on, Chris.
No problem at all. Thank you guys for having me again. I appreciate it.
And now, as always, time for our significant digit, which is a telling number from the world of sports this week, given that Buddy Ryan passed away, the famous NFL coach who coached the Bears and the Eagles.
Lots of coaching death.
Yeah. We thought that we'd get a significant digit on Buddy Ryan here to deliver it, making his podcasting debut.
Woohoo!
Yay!
538 Sports intern for the summer, Cetridge Crawford. Cetridge, welcome to Hot Takedown.
Thank you. 72 is the number of sacks that the 85 Bears put up in the championship season under Buddy Ryan. That record still stands today.
Wow. 72, and that was all season long. Wow. So I think of the 85 Bears defense as like one of the legendary ones. They had the shuffle,
The 4-6, 46.
46, yes. Yeah.
Neil, do the numbers suggest Buddy Ryan's defense was as good as we
think
it is?
Well, what's really funny is if you look at Football Outsiders DVOA, which is defense adjusted value over
We've gone so long since you mentioned
that. We have to have so many acronyms.
I was hoping you had turned a page in
like
the new
that.
Year.
Why now?
I know. The best defense that's associated with Buddy Ryan was actually the 91 Eagles defense, even though he was not the coach that year. He had been the coach the previous year. Oddly, the 85 Bears rank lower than I thought they would. They rank 16th by DVOA.
We're trying to honor Buddy Ryan.
Yeah, I know.
Here you are.
I know. Well, they're tied with the 2015 Super Bowl champion Denver Broncos, though. So good company, Super Bowl company in that regard. But
so what were they dancing
great
about?
Great defense.
Nothing.
It was a great defense, Chad. You know, the numbers aren't everything.
In my world, you do not dance unless you are the best at something. That's the only time I dance.
Really,
when I
Chad?
Feel like I'm,
really,
I'm,
Chad?
I'm the best.
You only dance when you feel like you're the best.
My favorite Buddy Ryan is the quote is that I think it's a piece of like a scouting report where he's talking about quarterbacks. And he's talking about like how his defense has to go after them because they're pompous, arrogant. Can we say bastards on this?
Yeah,
sure.
We said worse.
Who deserve to be sacked? Like it's just the greatest sort of motivation for a defensive player. Who, you know, defensive players always like under respected, not paid as much. And now here was this quote, like in the scouting report, where it was like, "Go get those bastards,
those pretty boy bastards."
Yeah, such a motivation there.
So how many sacks was it? 72.
72. Yes.
Holy crap! That's coincidentally that's the same number that under Buddy Ryan, Randall Cunningham got sacked the next year when he was the coach of the Eagles. So I guess
Neil,
both
we're trying to honor
to...
Buddy Ryan with this sig dick.
It's a testament to how he
Neil,
was.
You're not invited to my funeral. You just like you're not going to come.
About defense, and he was just like, the offense, you guys, you're a bunch of pretty boys, you know. No regard for the quarterback on either team, but you got to respect that, a defensive coach through and through.
All right, Cetridge, thanks for bringing the number.
Stellar debut.
Yes, we should also note, of course, that
thanks
without
for
Buddy
me.
We wouldn't have Rex and Rob, the whole Ryan clan.
Ah, yes.
And that's kind of a mixed blessing too. Sorry,
whoa.
Wow, no respect for the dead.
Look, you know, maybe Kevin Gilbride is one of my best friends. I don't know.
Oh, my gosh. All right. Enough out of you. All right. That will do it for this week's show. Thanks to Kate Fagan. Kate, good luck on book leave.
Thanks, Chad.
Write those 15K.
15,000 words and the book will be done.
You're going to turn in your phone on the way out the door?
Yep.
Okay.
And if you see me tweeting.
Oh, man.
Text me.
So many shame
slack
mentions.
Slack me.
Yeah. Okay.
But what if the Knicks do something else exciting?
Then I should tweet.
Or something exciting.
What if John Starks becomes the GM of the Knicks?
Yeah.
Do you guys think it's possible that John Starks being traded has led to all of this bad luck?
I think you can completely draw that, you know, line.
It's a Ruthian comparison for the Knicks?
I thought you couldn't get more rational.
The curse
just the hottest hot take I've offered on here.
Neil Payne, thanks as always to you as well.
Sure.
Our podcast producer is Joe Sykes. Our podcast defensive coordinator is Jody Avergan. Tony Chow around the board for us in the studio. We got production assistance from Jonathan Yales and Cedric Crawford. You can email us at podcast@538.com. We would love to hear what you think. You can also find us on SoundCloud. We're actually not on SoundCloud anymore. I've got to edit that out of my script, but we are still on Stitcher, Downcast, and your favorite podcasting app. We're also on iTunes. Subscribe at itunes.com/538. While you're there, review and or rate our show. It actually does help others discover the program. We also at 538 have a few other shows. Look for 538 Elections podcast. I hear there's an election happening. And What's the Point, which is our podcast about data in society. Our theme song is by Mystery Mansion. I'm Chadwick Matlin. Talk to you next time.